Welcome to a Monday edition of our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue, along with Ray Graff and Alan Chartok, who will join us momentarily here in Studio A. Good morning. We have an interesting discussion of some interesting issues. I think it'll be an interesting
set. Let's hope.
Let's put it this way. It looks good on paper.
Well, there you go.
It looks good on paper. And as always, we welcome your thoughts on these various issues by going to roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our Facebook page. You can also go to our webpage. You can also tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. And we're going to start off. We have a lot of issues that we want to discuss. Ray just mentioned the Anthony Weiner story in the
news headlines
about that he is vowed to stay in the race. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We're also going to go to the other side of the nation and talk about their mayoral troubles with the mayor of San Diego, which is a fascinating story as well. And we'll wait till Alan gets here to talk about those. Interesting story that made the front page of the USA Today. This is an Associated Press story, actually. 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least parts of their lives, a sign of deteriorating economic security and an elusive American dream. Survey data exclusive to the Associated Press points to an increasingly globalized U.S. economy, the widening gap between rich and poor, and the loss of good-paying manufacturing jobs as reasons for the trend. I think what is important to note in this headline and in the story, because when you hear the four out of five people face near poverty and no work, I think that's a very, very scary number.
Yeah.
And very, quite frankly, close to the 10% that we've, the 90% that we've heard about and the 10% who do well. What I think you have to key in on, though, however, is the turn for at least parts of their lives.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? Is that right out of school? Is that right out of, is that not graduating from high school? Is that being born into poverty? At what point is that? Not that it matters, of course, but it is interesting where we're not looking at a snapshot of right now. We are saying at some point in their life, 4 out of 5 have faced near poverty and no work. The findings come as President Obama tries to renew his administration's emphasis on the economy, saying in recent speeches that his highest priority is to rebuild ladders of opportunity and reverse income inequality. Is non-whites approach a numerical majority in the U.S.? One question is how public programs to lift the disadvantage should be best focused on the affirmative action that historically has tried to eliminate the racial barriers seen as the major impediment to economic equality, or simply on improving socioeconomic status for all, regardless of race.
Yeah.
Hardship, particularly growing among whites, based on several measures. Pessimism among that racial group about their family's economic futures has climbed to the highest point since 1987, at least. In the most recent AP poll, 63% of whites call the economy poor. And I think when you look at that term pessimism and the fact that people are pessimistic and don't feel that the comedy, well, two things. One, they feel that the economy is poor, and two, they don't feel that it will improve, says an awful lot.
Yes. Well, I think the more interesting thing about this is how what they term economic insecurity, which is basically 150% of the poverty line or below. So once you hit age 60, it's something like 76%. Are in that economic insecurity. So with the graying of the country, That's just terrifying. Don't you think?
Yes, because you are now working and working and working and working to get to a point in your life where you will not be able to sustain a lifestyle that you were working so hard to attain.
And I mean, you know, we're, you know, young scamps, but it's right around the corner for us as well. And it's, I got to say, it's a terrifying prospect. What will change in the economy and indeed society to make everyone less pessimistic? I don't see what's going to happen.
More than, engulfing more than 76% of white adults by the time they turn 60, according to a new economic gauge being published next year by the Oxford University Press. This is economic insecurity. And the gauge defines economic insecurity as a year or more of periodic joblessness.
Yeah.
Reliance on government aid, such as food stamps, or income below 150% of the poverty line.
Measured... Now, you know what the poverty line is? It's about 23 grand for a family of four.
Right.
Now, having a family of seven, I got to tell you something, 23,000 doesn't go very, I mean, poverty is, that doesn't go far at all.
So your way of gauging that is doubling that.
But
saying,
what I'm saying is you're 23 would not be close.
No, not even close. Of course not. And measured across all races, the risk of economic insecurity rises to 79%.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, 79%. That is that's a huge number. I think that when you look, obviously you can play with numbers however you want.
Absolutely.
You can make them look as dire or as optimistic as you want them. However, I think that given that there are so many facets to the economic troubles, and there's so many facets to the problem, that the fact that you can throw so many numbers out that are so depressing says an awful lot.
Absolutely.
Census figures provide an official measure of poverty, but they're only a temporary snapshot that don't capture the makeup of those who cycle in and out of poverty at different points in their lives. They may be suburbanites, for example, or the working poor, or the laid off. In 2011, that snapshot showed 12.6% of adults in their prime working ages of 25 to 60 lived in poverty.
Yeah.
But measured in terms of a person's lifetime risk, a much higher number, 4 in 10, falls into poverty for at least 1 year of their lives. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will talk about other stories making news. Alan Chartok will join us as well. We always welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after the short break.
Support comes from Godfrey Financial Associates, Latham, New York, providing retirement planning and wealth management services for baby boomers and beyond. Independent, woman-owned, established 1995, GodfreyFinancial.com. Center for Better Hearing, Glens Falls, New York. Dr. Susan Bajaj and Kara Bador, providing comprehensive hearing and hearing aid services. HearingBest.com. Singer-songwriter Laura Wetzler, original folk rock, world beat Jewish music, and American classics. 4 p.m. Sunday, September 22nd at North Hall, Huntington, Massachusetts. LauraWetzler.com. Mother Earth Storehouse, Kingston, Poughkeepsie, and Socrates. Natural Food and Vitamin Center serving the Hudson Valley with organic and natural foods since 1978. MotherEarthStorehouse.com for recipes and store events.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel. Ray Graff is here and Dr. Alan Chartok joins us as well. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. I'm on a tear.
Excellent. It is. when aren't you on a tear, by the way? It's great to have you here. Thank you very much. We want to talk. This is the story that won't go away. This is the story that is dominating headlines. And what? You wish it would go away?
I'm so sick of this.
It was obviously dominant in our newscast. It was dominant in Morning Edition this morning, and that is Anthony Weiner. His campaign manager quit over the weekend. I think what was that was one.
Yeah.
That was one. Two is that the Sunday morning talk shows were just plagued with people from really top Democratic national officials, everybody from Obama advisor David Axelrod to Dee Dee Myers, former spokeswoman for Bill Clinton, came out and said that it's time for him to resign and to,
yeah,
and to get out of the race. Mm-hmm. David Axelrod perhaps was the most vague on Meet the Press, saying he is a waste of time and space.
I think he is delusional at this point. He should just go away. I think that... I don't know. I think he should not mince words about this.
Can you read between the lines there, Ray,
and
help
me
a little bit of what he's trying to get? So if you're President Obama and your senior advisor, former senior advisor, but obviously with very close ties to the President of the United States, goes on a national talk show, Sunday talk show, and says, look, buddy, it's time to hang it up. What kind of pressure does that put on you?
Well, there are a couple of things. It puts a lot of pressure on you. But here's what I've been arguing with my colleagues, my esteemed colleagues, who have been saying he has to quit. I don't think he has to quit. I think he can't quit. If he quits, he's done in politics forever. He has to go and he has to face the electorate, and at least that way he says he stuck it out. Now, there's something that is really sort of bothering me here. Maybe you and Ray and your eloquence and your intellect could help me with this. Why why is it? Why
Ray and I are searching for our eloquence and our intellect.
Why is
my
it?
My desk.
Why is it that so many national figures are saying get out? In other words, what's the motivation for getting him out? That he makes them look bad?
Yeah, of course, he makes the Democratic Party look bad.
Yeah. Well, I'm not through yet.
I'm sorry. I'll
let you know.
That was a rhetorical question.
I'll let you know.
Pardon me.
I'll let you know, and I expect that you will speak
long and hard on
this. Okay. I think the fact of the matter is, again, it looks bad because the electorate should make this decision. So what is it about this that is making them so unhappy? I suspect, having seen him rise to the top of the pool once before, they're afraid it may happen again. And you say it makes them look bad, but I also suspect they're worried about this guy.
Okay.
And they want him out.
So let me just ask a hypothetical question.
Sure, of course.
At what point, I mean, we how many times have we been faced with a dilemma like this, when I say dilemma, but a political dilemma where a candidate has done something, has said something. So at what point do you make, I guess, what is the arbiter for you of when they should get out of something so heinous, or the something that they should stake it out and just let the electorate take care of it?
Well, you know, I think they're making a mistake. I think that the Democratic crowd, I think they're making a mistake by pushing it this hard. It makes them look terrified.
Shouldn't they be, though, to some extent?
Why?
Because I think it's become an embarrassment.
Embarrassment, but they're making it more of an embarrassment.
I don't know. I mean, Alan, I mean, I was reading the text over the weekend. I mean, the text that he sent back and forth with this woman who is now on every talk show in the country. I mean, these are disgusting, graphic texts that were done after he said he was counseled, and what I'm saying is that, okay, so whatever we want to talk about that, the fact is that it's become a circus.
Well, I agree.
And you cannot, and there is the question of, you know, do you want your party, and yes, we're all for democracy, but do you want your party represented in any way, shape, or form who someone who even talks like this, who thinks like this, who treats women like this, and have them as a spokesperson for your party when other candidates are trying to talk about legitimate issues that face the city?
I must say I do agree with Alan in that it should be up to the voters. But if I'm in the Democratic Party, I do everything I can to say, look, you need to go away now. But
exactly.
I agree with Alan's basic point. If a voter can't figure it out, then Good heavens. It's on the voter.
I agree with you, except that as long as he's in the race, this becomes the only issue that is discussed within the city of New York.
My problem is that I never get a chance to say anything around here.
Oh, yes, that's the problem. Yes. Yeah, that is the
Hang
problem.
On. Let me put that on the quote board.
Yeah, that's well documented.
No, I mean, there are two things, and I've said them, and I know they're coming around a second time. But the first thing is so clear, which is that first of all, I never liked him. I've told you that many times. I never liked him. I wouldn't have voted for him if I was down there. I always thought he was a jerk. I thought he was a jerk before jerk was fashionable. That's a country tune, you know.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah. And the second part of this is that while I agree, Joe, that he is an embarrassment, I don't think he's got any motivation for getting out. Because I think once this guy is out, he's gone for politics forever. He knows it. So he has to stick it out.
So
metaphorically,
but I guess that. But
what did
I guess
you say,
that
Ray,
mean,
I'm sorry, I missed that.
No one missed
Let's
that.
Let's move on.
That was a train coming down Broadway.
By my saying I missed that,
yes.
I wanted to give emphasis.
My question still remains, though. What becomes bad enough where you say, okay, it's not up to the voters? That certainly there can be pressure from the party. We see this in presidential contests all the time, in primaries. We see this in other races where the party comes in and says, look, this has become a distraction, this has become an embarrassment, and it's time to move on. So what I'm trying to ascertain from you is what is the tipping point for that to be a legitimate complaint?
I don't know what else you could say. I mean, in other words, what, he wrote more of these things?
No. What I'm saying is that hypothetically,
yes,
if you're looking at a candidate,
if they find out he murdered somebody, maybe.
Okay.
You have him arrested. What he did was not, according to what I understand, against the law.
You're right.
You know, he just opened up his fat yap and did something really stupid and now has to be held accountable by the voters if they decide they want to hold him accountable. Look, Ray and I, for once, are on the same side.
Unbelievably,
on this,
yes.
On the same side of this. Because it's really just a matter of their embarrassment in the party. They are embarrassed. They don't want him there. He's inconvenient.
But you can understand why they're embarrassed.
Of course, if I were them, as we say in political science, role-playing, role theory, I might do the same thing,
so
but I'm not them.
If you have a guy who's out there and he's saying horrible things to women, or he's saying horrible things, he's making racial slurs, or if he's...
Did he make racial slurs?
No, but no. I'm saying if.
Well,
remember,
okay. Well, let's stick to the sort of fact pattern.
Okay, well, the fact pattern is that he's being degrading and awful to women. Okay,
there's no question about it, which is why he's a jerk.
All right, so then isn't that... I mean, to me, isn't that hit some point where as a Democratic leader, you can say, you know what, we think you should step aside?
Well, let's go back to the business about degrading to women for a moment. I have not read those texts. I just know, you know, the news reports and what was said. You say you read the actual texts back and forth. Now, a lot of people, a lot of men and women talk to each other in funny ways.
This is not funny.
I understand.
But it does take two to tango. And this was a back and forth with this woman.
Uh-huh.
Yes?
Uh-huh.
Yes, I agree.
I think Ray's got you now, Joe.
No, I mean, I agree. I really do think you should. I mean, look.
I haven't read them either.
You know, they're disgusting. So. And also, look, personally, I think she was baiting him.
Are you suggesting somebody put her up to it?
No, I think that she knew what she had, and she was, I mean, and now she's on the talk show, she's doing the circuit, and she's doing the whole thing.
Just
so,
like Spitzer's accusers.
You know, right, but I think, but I think she was playing, certainly he is more... more chatty, let's put it that way, in these texts
okay.
than she is.
Well, let me ask a question to you fellas. All right. This is obviously a social or some sort of a psychological quirk, a flaw in this fellow.
Okay.
Now,
there have been many a politician who have had been drinkers, who have had all sorts of problems. Where then do you draw the line and say, well, you have this issue. You are unable to do anything. I mean, there have been plenty of politicians who liked a couple of cocktails, a couple more than a couple.
And plenty of politicians who had to do with Nufki Pufki.
Which, right.
What's that now?
You know what it is.
Nufki Pufki?
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one for the quote.
It's from a nursery rhyme. Nufki Pufki, pudding and pie.
So anyway, text the girls and make them cry.
Right, there you go. We're going to take a break. It seems like a fine time to take a break. But let's stop right there, because then it's a perfect time to move over then to what is happening in San Diego with the mayor there. And I'm curious as to Alan's position as to whether the mayor of the mayor of San Diego should resign. It's getting rough. What do you do? Let's go to take a break. We're going to hear some NPR news, and we'll be back. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org. Welcome back to our Roundtable Panel for this Monday, the 29th of July. I'm Joe Donahue, along with Alan Shartok and Ray Graff. Good morning to all. We've been talking a lot about the Anthony Weiner story, and during the break, I read to my colleagues in great dramatic fashion the text that they had not read yet.
Appalling.
And after my dramatic reading, have your opinions changed at all?
Well, I look forward to your appearance on Selected Shorts. I'll tell you that. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be quite something.
No, it really is quite remarkable, except it's the stuff you read, if anybody did. I never have,
of course not.
In Playboy or Penthouse.
Yeah. He only looks at it for the pictures.
Hey, I don't even look at it for that. I live with a lovely lady who would not tolerate it.
All right, sir.
All right, but does that make it? But again, you know, that would be written for an entertainment purpose and for fantasy, where this is being written to a specific woman.
And the woman, as Ray pointed out before, was writing back, and basically, if I heard your words correctly this morning, encouraging it.
Yes. All right.
So.
But I don't know.
So what you had is two stupid consenting adults. Writing back and forth, except one was running for mayor.
Okay.
And, of course, that's why.
Well, this is before he was running
that's
for
why,
mayor.
That's why, as Christine Lavin always sings, how could he? You know.
Okay, yeah. So now you have the San Diego mayor, besieged by accusations of sexual harassment. Bob Filner of San Diego announced on Friday that he would enter 2 weeks of what he described as intensive behavior therapy. I don't know.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. Look, I think he broke the law. If I'm reading this correctly, you're not allowed to sexually harass people, put your hands on them,
this is different.
And the rest of it.
You know, Weiner and company, electrons in the air, stupidity, rampant. This seems to be physical menacing and whatever else. This is a different ball of wax here, right?
Yes.
Okay, so then we don't have to talk about that anymore.
No, I don't think we need to make. Need to make parallels. No. However, I do think that when you talk about issues like this, at what point? Well, 2 points. One, maybe not be fair, but at one point, you know, if you see danger signs going into the election before you elect the guy, you know, do you?
Yeah.
Do you perhaps do something? But two, once
this guy was a real hero. This guy was a real hero in San Diego.
And once you have him in office, I guess the other parallel being, people are calling for Weiner to drop out. People are calling for this guy to resign. And you know, at what point do you say, okay, we'll let the voters decide in 2 years, or do they have a real right to say, look, you got to get rid of this guy?
Well, if it turns out that he broke the law, then they have every right to throw him out, and should. If it turns out that he broke the law, but I don't know that that's fully been established yet. I know one thing: that one does not in a workplace go around, putting their hands on their employees.
Seven women have publicly accused. Bless you, by the way.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
Seven women have publicly accused the mayor of sexual harassment. He indicated that he would keep a hand in City Hall, even from the seclusion of his treatment program, saying that he planned to be briefed every morning and every evening on what was taking place. And he said, that I must become a better person. He did not name the treatment facility or explain who would be paying for his stay there. The mayor is going into treatment during a quiet time in San Diego's government. The city council goes on recess the day that the treatment starts and does not return until September 9th. So the question also is, at what point do you, we're talking about crime. Well, obviously there have been seven women who have made allegations. So do you step aside while those allegations are investigated, or do you, and here again, you have major party officials calling for his resignation. You have people throughout the state of California calling for his resignation. You have people in San Diego calling for his resignation. How patient are you with a situation like that, given that it took so long to get him to even admit that A, there was a problem, and B, that he would seek some sort of therapy for it?
Who are you looking at?
I'll look at you.
He's cooked. I mean, he's just cooked. You know, I don't know. I wish I knew my California law better. Do they have recall in California?
I don't know.
I don't know. So in any case, if that's available to them, it certainly is one possibility. But it seems to me that if in an look, this would not, if people fall in love in a workplace, we've had it happen here at WAMC, it happens. I think that the crucial issue is unwanted. And clearly, if you got seven people saying it was unwanted and there are very specifics being quoted, you know, I've got no tolerance for it.
The flood of accusations was accompanied by a steady crumbling of support for Mr. Filner from the city's political establishment. On Thursday night, the San Diego County Democratic Party called on Filner to step aside, joining members of Congress and the city council and his most influential supporter, Lorena Gonzalez, a state assemblywoman who was secretary treasurer of the San Diego Labor Organization that pumped close to $2 million into his race. And it is interesting. San Diego obviously has had many scandals over the years with a line of mayors, oddly enough, who have stepped aside, including Richard Murphy, who was forced out of office in 2005 with a pension financing crisis, deserving the title, which he had, Enron by the Sea.
Nice.
Yeah, very nice. Mm. Troubles in San Diego as well. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have several other stories to talk about. And we have a letter or two to read about an earlier story on the economic situation. We will get to those. And plus, a reminder that you can always join in on the discussion, roundtable at WAMC.org. We're coming back right after this short break.
I'm Brian Shields, WAMC News, inviting you to join me weekday evenings at 6 o'clock for Northeast Report Late Edition. The day is winding down, and All Things Considered has wrapped up its work for the day. But WAMC is there with regional news from our bureau chiefs, a Wall Street and business update, and the weather summary. Northeast Report Late Edition, weekday evenings at 6 o'clock on WAMC Northeast Public Radio.
Welcome back to the roundtable panel this morning. Dr. Alan Chartok joins us, and Ray Graff is here as well. And we are always willing and able to take your thoughts. Yeah. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us go to a note that we got from Laura, who says, thank you for your discussion regarding poverty in America. My school abolished my teaching position in January, mid-year, with no notice after 26 years. Last year, people were notified in March that they would be laid off in June. That gave them time to save up money, meet with spouses, financial support, and financial advisors, use up insurances, et cetera. I was given no opportunity to do any of this. This came out of the poll that we read earlier this morning, that 4 in 5 in the USA face near poverty or no work at some point in their life. Thankfully, she writes, I have lived frugally, house vehicles,
et cetera, are paid off. I tried to save a little and not to carry a balance on my credit card. I'm almost out of savings. Unemployment is ending. I'm alone, so have no spouse's income to depend on. I don't know how much longer I can stay in my home. All the jobs want applicants to apply electronically. I can't even get a reply, and the jobs are all 30 hours and pay minimum wage to $10 an hour. And as Ray mentioned, I cannot live on $240 to $300 a week before taxes and whatever would be taken out for health insurance. I don't know how people do it who have children, owe on a car, loan, or mortgage. I thank you for the show.
Yeah.
And you can certainly hear her despair as well. And when you talk about the numbers and the dire nature of things, I mean, to me, this comes into a class of who amongst us does not know someone or is someone who falls into this category.
You know, the other day, the president got up and made remarks about the difference between the distance between the rich and the poor in this country. And, you know, you mentioned poor, and most middle class people tend not to be as sympathetic as I think they ought to be. But you start talking about the middle class and a person who was a teacher and who is educated and who can't afford, you know, the basic necessities of life. And then you see the people in the United States House of Representatives trying to cut out food stamps for the people who are the most, you know, at risk in this country, whose kids, there was a story on NPR this morning, whose kids would literally starve without those food stamps. And we're talking about food stamps that buy a lot of cereal as opposed to, you know, anything that's frivolous. And then, of course, you see somebody come out and say, well, in this city, there was a scandal. We just caught some people using food stamps for inappropriate reasons. And therefore, all people who get food stamps in the United States, and this brings us right, are disgraceful. And this brings us right back to what we've been talking about. So you have a president, and he's talking to something that many Americans understand based on this poll you're just saying about how close to poverty so many people are. So I'm just blown away by the new statistics. I am.
It is a it is something that is reflected in another story that I want to get to, and this is in the New York Times this morning, and it's over the issue of abortion. And this also made the Sunday talk shows this morning. And you have Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Rob Portman coming together and saying that they believe that this should be, that abortion should be a major issue and something that the Republican Party should look at. They want to advance a bill in the Senate to ban abortion at 20 weeks after fertilization. A similar ban passed the House last month, and Senate Democrats quickly pronounced it doomed to fail in their chamber. Almost certain to be defeated there, and even if it were not, President Obama would veto it. But backers of the ban are eager to bring it to the floor of the Senate, the same impassioned debate over abortion that has been taking place in state legislatures across the country. What I find interesting about this, to get back to your point from a moment ago, Alan, is Republicans are hardly unanimous about the wisdom of entangling themselves in a national battle over abortion rights. Many believe that the party should remain focused on addressing economic issues and fighting Mr. Obama's health care overhaul. John Barrasso of Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, a member of the Republican leadership, said, "I'm focused on energy, the economy, and what's happening with the president's health care law." Asked whether he thought abortion was a distraction for his party, he stuck to a popular Republican refrain, "I'm completely focused on jobs, the economy, the health care law."
You know, Joe, it all does, I think, come down to primaries. It depends on how your district has been configured. If, in fact, you're the Texas legislature and you've made a whole bunch of districts that are basically Tea Party districts, and you know that you're going to face, if you're a moderate Republican, you're going to face the wrath of the people who turn out in primaries. And we're talking about, you know, 15, sometimes 10% of the eligible voters coming out in a primary, and they're the most motivated, and often, but not always, but often, they are the right wing of that party, of the Republican Party, that come out and do that. And then you're scared, and you say, okay, let me reach into the bag of tricks and see which one will turn these people on the most, and it's abortion. It has been for years, and it is abortion. And so if you say to them, come on, this isn't good for the country. This isn't good for you. This isn't good for your daughter if she happens to get pregnant. This isn't good for women and our advancement in this country. And they know it, and they still say, hey, I got to win an election.
Does it win an election, though?
I think in some places it does. I think in some places it doesn't. But if you take a look at what's been happening in this country, when more conservative people come into the race, they win, and they're often winners. And so, I think it's really simple. I think that is what is going on.
I was reading this article last night, and I just thought, this is an issue. This is one of many, but this is an issue that will never go away, right? I mean, no matter what happens in legislatures, whether this is passed or not passed or overturned at some point, this is never going to go away.
Well, I want to mention something, Joe, in terms of something you said a few seconds ago, and that is it passes, something like this passes in the House, it goes to the Senate, which is held by a few people. You read Nate Silver's piece. He says the Senate could go Republican now. And so I think it could go much, much further. The president vetoes it. There's no way that the Congress is going to override a presidential veto on abortion. They just don't have the numbers. But it is still a powerful political tool, and it'll go quiescent for a while, and every once in a while it'll come back and really, really hit you in the nose.
So we're talking about who it helps and who it doesn't, and I asked the question of, you know, does it help in some areas? And you said, yes, it does, and you know, depending on where you are.
Right.
So you look at somebody like Marco Rubio, who is leading the charge here, and is... it seems, has national aspirations,
sure,
and it is trying to raise his national profile. Is this the way to do that?
Well, President Reagan did it. Same thing.
And yeah. Alan's point, I think, is a good one, because you have this election in 2014, and there are those conservative Democrats that need to get reelected, and I don't think the Democrats want to touch this vote with a 10-foot pole. So in other words, wait until after the election and then discuss it. So I'm wondering if anything's going to happen with this at all.
Well, I'm sorry, Joe.
No, it doesn't seem like anything is going to happen. But still, by bringing up the discussion,
they own it.
They own it. And then how does that maintain itself from 2 years from now when you're talking about a presidential election?
You may have the presidential election, and you may have a Republican United States Senate. I don't think that's going to happen, by the way, but there are very good people. And Silver, as you remember,
yeah,
was right on in his predictions on the presidential election. So I think he has, and his predictions have to be taken very seriously.
And his prediction was basically that there is a reasonable chance that the Senate will go
Republican.
And then,
right,
then he went to ESPN. So,
right,
you know,
and we'll now
be predicting
he's
the Super Bowl
with...
winners next
no,
week.
Or Derek Jeter.
Yeah.
Gets another hit. First time at bat. Home run.
Gets up again.
Yeah, not right if he can walk again. All right. So do we need, are we all caught up, or do I need to take a break? Okay, we're all caught up. Excellent. So here's a story that I found interesting too. I will admit I have a fear in this world. I was actually playing a game with children over the weekend, and one of the questions that was asked is, what do you fearful
yeah.
of?
Yeah.
I'm not a big bridge guy.
No.
I don't.
You mean a bridge that you go over?
Yeah.
Sure.
I'm not a big bridge guy.
Yeah.
I don't really like them. Yeah. I'm not. I don't like them. So then I saw this story in USA Today. This comes out of Connecticut, but obviously a national story. And that the reason this comes out of Connecticut is it has the nation's second highest percentage of major roads with pavement in poor condition. And 25 other states have 20% or more of their roads and bridges in such condition, according to analysis of federal Highway Administration data.
Hmm.
So
I would rather have a road be in bad condition than a bridge.
Well, yeah, but either or, you know, yeah, they do
often connect.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And and then, so edges of a two-lane road that are worn and recessed, rainwater to pool, then the water gets in and further erodes the system. Even though, here's some statistics. 38% of the pavement on roads stretching miles across the USA is in good condition, according to the analysis, while about 1 in 10 of the nation's bridges are structurally deficient. Think of how many bridges you go over on your way to work in a commute.
I never like it. I go over the George Washington Bridge. Boy, I go as fast as I possibly
can. Is that how you get here from Great Barrier?
Yeah, you go over the George Washington Bridge.
You put on the bridge.
That's a hell of a commute.
Yeah,
that
was, or the, what is that?
It was a few minutes late this
what
morning.
What is that one, the Patroon Island Bridge?
Yeah, Patroon Island Bridge.
Comes over and you look, but the scariest one of all, apparently, is, you know, Tappan Zee.
I don't care too much about bridges, but that one always was, as a
well,
kid,
because,
going over
because apparently you could look down in some of the places and see water.
Yeah, but even,
I'm not sure.
But you know, even in a small town, you look at a bridge that goes over a
sure.
river, you look at a
troubled
bridge
waters.
Over, and that's troubled bridges over troubled waters. And you, and you look at, you know, what I would term a simple bridge, you know, not as something as grand as the Brooklyn yeah. Bridge or the Tappan Zee Bridge. However, it's a bridge. But you know, if you fall, if you go through it, you know, you're going to die. I don't think there's really too much of a question about that.
Yeah.
If below you are rocks and moving water, chances are not good for you if you go through it. And then to be told that those are deficient in some way and that 1 in 10 are deficient seems to me to be scary. What I found interesting about this is all despite the stimulus influx. So all of this money was coming in from the stimulus to help improve our roads and bridges, and yet we see 2 years later that still is not really taken into account, and the roads and bridges are still in very poor
condition.
Well,
what was it like before the stimulus? I mean, was it 10 times worse? We don't know, right?
No, actually, we do know, and it's not getting any better. No,
but the patronage jobs really went well, so it worked out fine.
You know what happened is it went into some places and didn't go into others, and when you look at it nationally, it did not improve. You know, it did improve in some municipalities,
yeah.
but it was not across the board, and it was not a sort of a punch list of what the major problems were in individual municipalities. Yeah.
Well, it also gets right down to our economic question as to whether or not we want to be parsimonious and get rid of debt, or whether or not, you know, you want to have a civilian conservation corps, which, you know, certainly we know worked with Roosevelt, stimulate the economy. And there are places in this world that do it both ways. You know, I happen to think if you put money into bridges and put people back to work and highways and put people, and obviously the governor of Massachusetts, one of my favorites, Deval Patrick, understands that, which is why he said to people, you know, let's have some more money so we can do this, a little bit more taxes. And everybody yelled back, hell no.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a figure in this article, state, federal, and local funds for road and bridge improvements are not adequate to meet the growing needs. About $85 billion is required annually to improve the condition of roads and bridges, nearly double what was spent in 2008. So we leave you with that this morning, and we also leave you with an invitation to write in and join in the discussion. All you have to do is go to roundtable at wamc.org. Raymond, Alan, thank you very much, as always.
All right,
it's
thank
a great
you.
Pleasure.
Great pleasure to be with you, Joe.
And right back to you.
Back to you.
And back to you.
Ping pong.
Bom, bing.
I'm getting out of here.
Medical Monday at 2 o'clock today, and don't forget that. And we will continue with our program next on WAMC.